I would like to thank you for your singing, "There's a Fountain Free." It is for you and me. And it's just coincidental, maybe. Maybe it's not. But I want to talk about a fountain free this evening later on. But we've all had that opportunity. We've all had that chance to drink of pure water, pure, clean water. And if you haven't, God is merciful tonight. You can as well. So I need to finish up my project with young people. And I have a lady that wants to get up and say the proverb from last night. So Miss Kayla, where are you? All right, stand up and speak up.
There is no honorable way to do a dishonorable thing.
Pretty close. Very good. Do you believe that? Okay, don't forget. You know, the day will come when you need to fill out your tax forms and you need to declare the value of certain things, or you need to negotiate with a policeman. There is no honorable way to do a dishonorable thing. Well, I'm going to give you one that's a little bit harder, and if you want your mom to write it down, you can. But I want someone to say it tomorrow evening. We are free to make our choices, but we are not free from the consequences of those choices. All right, let's say it together. We are free to make our choices, but we are not free from the consequences of those choices. And so I see young people and even adults making choice after choice. And then they wonder why it's not working out. You can't have it both ways. The choice you make has consequence, and many of them eternal consequence. Title of what I want to share with y'all this evening is called the Cyanide Flats. That don't mean anything to you now. But I hope that when I get done, there's not a doubt in anybody's mind what I'm talking about. I don't know if I told you or not, Grace, my wife is from Red Lake, Ontario. She was born and raised there. Her father still lives there. I lived in that area for 7 years in the middle 70s to the middle 80s. I want to give you a little bit of history. Red Lake, Ontario was started in 1926. And there was these prospectors going through the Canadian Shield, and they would had their rock hammers and chips, and they were looking for gold. And Red Lake is between southern Ontario, which is actually way better than Lancaster County or Rockingham County. beautiful farmland in southern Ontario. You've been there. You've seen it. Red Lake lies in this Canadian Shield, that area between southern Ontario and Manitoba, where the prairies start, and it's flat as a flitter all the way to the Rockies. It's called the Canadian Shield. It's a rugged land of lakes and forests and giant rock outcroppings with very small areas that are suitable for farming. But there are a few. One is New Liskeard. It's on the Ontario-Quebec border, about 500 miles north of southern Ontario. And there's several congregations of fellowship people up that way. Cochrane, Ontario. Went up there through that country for my brother-in-law's wedding, and there was a few dairies up there and some cattle, but that country is so far north, and it's not for the faint of heart. Summer is real short. And then there's some pockets of open land around Dryden, Ontario, close to where Northern Youth Programs is, and the Swiss have settled there. The Swiss can sell their quota and their steep land in Switzerland, and they can move to Canada, and that country is suited for them. It seems that Anabaptist people have settled into all those places as well. Wherever there's good farmland, it's said that the Anabaptist people will come. They're looking for good farmland. And I used to always tease my dad and my Uncle Howard Brubaker that they sure can't accuse them of that when they moved to Bamberg County, South Carolina. And they chapped a little bit, I think, but they smiled. Compared to other regions where people live and have settled, where farming thrives, in Western Canada, Red Lake is actually not all that far north. It's about 300 miles north of International Falls, Minnesota. But the polar jet streams come down out of the Hudson Bay and dump these Arctic air masses on that place. And it is so cold. The winters are very long. The summers very short. And I have seen snow there every month of the year at Sandy Lake, Ontario, where Grace and I lived. Any time of the year, you can dig down and hit frost. There's enough warm soil on top that trees, and you can plant a little garden if you eat potatoes and cabbage, but there's frost in the ground where we lived. Until the early 1920s, only Native or First Nations people lived in that area, and they were a nomadic people, hunters and gatherers, trappers, fishermen. They grew very little food, and they would take canoes and dog teams and portage and take big freighter canoes and go to Winnipeg and places like that to get flour and lard to help them with their other food that they could get off of the land. It was very slow and very hard work. And they would tell me, the old Native men would tell me, of portaging 120 pounds of flour. They'd walk and then go back and get the canoe and reload them. And they used the leather strap across their head. I mean, 120 pounds gets heavy unless you're JP. Maybe you could do it, but I'm not that good of a man. In 1925, prospectors pushed north by dog team in early open cockpit airplanes into what is now Red Lake, Ontario. Gold was discovered there, and gold makes normal people think very weird things. And the news of the discovery was printed in the big newspapers in the United States and Canada, Toronto, Chicago. And in that first year, over 5,000 people swarmed up there into that rugged and desolate area. And there was 18,000 claims registered at the mining office in Kenora, Ontario, that first year. We're talking about desolate bush country. 5,000 people up there. What are they going to eat? Tree bark? And beavers don't taste that good. I mean, unlike the placer gold of the Klondike or the California gold rushes, Red Lake is what is known as lode gold. Lode gold is a deposit within a solid rock. And so the prospectors were looking for rock. And so now when you go up there, they got these diamond drillers that drill down hundreds of feet and find a core. And then they can send it to the lab. But they used rocks and chisels. They were looking for gold veins in rock and not gold nuggets in the rivers, like in California. As is always the case, a few won big, but most of those would-be rich, quick prospectors went bust. And there was two significant gold rushes in Red Lake since the early 1920s. In 1944, a vein was discovered that produced up to 9 ounces of gold per ton of rock. That mine is still in existence today. So how much is a ton of rock? A cubic yard of rock weighs 2,500 pounds, over a ton. And so for a ton of rock, it's 3 feet by 3 feet, you could get 9 ounces of gold. And that's a pretty big chunk of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so That's why there were so many people there. And as of July 2020, over 30 million ounces of gold have been dug out of Red Lake, or 9,375 tons. It's a very high quality gold that's mined there. Red Lake, Ontario has the richest gold ore deposits in Canada, perhaps in all the world. The latest mine in Red Lake is 2,500 meters deep, or 8,200 feet, 1.5 miles. It is so deep that they have to pump cold air down in there so the miners can work comfortably. Now, JP is going to pass a picture. I usually put it on the wall up here, but I'm going to pass one down each row and you can look. This is a rock out of the Red Lake, one of the Red Lake gold mines. That's how thick the gold is there, some of them. In biblical times, the gold-bearing rock was beaten and crushed by hammers until it was small enough, little tiny pieces, that they could put it in the fire and heat it, and then the gold was melted out of the rock or the little gravels. And then it would be collected, and then they heated and purified it by fire. And we have a lot of verses in the Old Testament and New Testament talks about the Christian life being compared to gold and being purified. And then we have the verse in 1 Peter 1:7. These have come so that your faith, greater than the worth of gold, which perishes, even though refined by fire, may be proven genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus is revealed. In 1817, there was this guy from Scotland called John MacArthur. Now, he wasn't the Calvinist guy over in Atlanta. But this is John MacArthur, the Scottishman. And he invented a way to extract gold without having to crush and burn it. You know, you crush it to a pulp and then burn it and then burn it some more. And he found that if you soaked gold ore in cyanide, that you could extract 90% of the gold out of the rock without having to do anything but just crack it. And then they would had this these slush systems where they washed it and the gold would be separated from the mine tailings. And so by the late 1800s, this process had become the gold standard for extraction of gold used in both the United States and Canada. Now, cyanide comes in several formulations, depending on the particular use or the purpose of the end product. All are very poisonous and toxic, but there's no evidence that any of them are a carcinogen. I did a fair amount of flying when the years that I was in the north. I wasn't the designated pilot, but I often had an airplane or I flew from community to community. And everywhere through the bush, you'd come to these areas where there was no vegetation, absolutely none. And if you looked in a little closer, you could look down and see old timbers and the remains of the mining buildings and things that were there. But there was always this area where nothing grew. And what it was, they would use cyanide to extract the gold from the ore, and they would just let that stuff, they'd pump this water and let it go down into a lake or a stream. And of course, that's against the law now, but back then they thought there was plenty of land to spoil. And so these barren wastelands, it's what we would call an environmental nightmare by today's standards, are no longer permitted. And so if you're going on the Trans-Canada Highway that goes from eastern Canada all the way to British Columbia, just north of the American border, when you get to Vermilion Bay, you turn north and go 100 miles, and you get to the end of the road, and that's Red Lake, Ontario. And those of you who read your mother-in-law's books know about Irvin Shantz, and he was my first boss. I could tell you story after story about Irvin Shantz, and he was good to me. As you drive through thousands of acres of pristine bush, jack pines, birch trees, muskeg, finally you'll come to the edge, just to the south edge of Red Lake, and there's a bright blue lake there, and it's like this huge sandy beach. It's like a tropical paradise without the palm trees. And it's a small, Red Lake's a small town. Bridgewater's getting pretty big, but I'm going to say it was kind of like Bridgewater. Everything happened in Red Lake. From there, all commerce north went by ski or float plane back in the day. Now it goes on wheel planes. That lake was the tailing pits for the early mines in Red Lake back in the 1920s and the 1940s. And the spent ore with the cyanide went into that little lake. It's not Red Lake proper, but it's a nice little lake in the edge of town. Grace and her siblings used to swim at the Cyanide Flats. That's why they call it that. It's a flat, sandy beach. And the cyanide kill, it's been 80 years. Nothing grows there. The Cyanide Flats. Grace seems no worse for it. But her little sister did die from bone cancer at the tender age of 16. But my research found that while it is very toxic to drink, it is not known to be carcinogenic. The water in the lake at Cyanide Flats is not pure and pristine looking for no reason. There's no life in them. At least that's what we were told. There's no plankton. There's no algae. There's nothing there to be the food chain. But you know, when I was there in the middle 70s, it's been long time, 40, 50 years since they poisoned this place. And so I got Steve Stalsfruce from Kentucky, Myron Mullett from Abbeville, y'all know him from Abbeville, South Carolina, and Dan Kurtz from Eastern Shore, Maryland, and we decided one evening to see if we could catch a fish at the Cyanide Flats. And more, we were just going out in a boat to enjoy each other's company. And so we went into Red Lake and found a way where we could portage a boat over into the Cyanide Flats. And I was driving the boat, and we was trolling, and Steve flipped his red and white lure in, and he was just trolling along. And after a while, I says, Carl, I said, I think you need to back up. I got a snag. So I put the outboard in reverse, but then the snag started to move a little bit. And the more we worked, the more we realized that we had this huge snapping turtle or the Loch Ness Monster on the end. It was starting to move. And, you know, after about 30 minutes or 40 minutes, Steve Stalsfuss picked up a trophy northern pike or jackfish. Evidently, this jackfish would come over there and rest, and then he'd go back into Red Lake to eat. And then so nobody would bother him, he'd swim around and come back into that lake. And either it wasn't that toxic anymore, but there was nothing in there for him to eat. I mean, it was beautiful blue water. We caught him. He was a real wall hanger. Now, I don't remember if Steve mounted him. I doubt if he did because, you know, on $25 mission stipend, we couldn't afford it. But I remember we didn't need him. He was full of cyanide, and he thought maybe he would poison us. So, that's my story. Here's my application. What do the scriptures teach us about the living water? I want to read from 1 Timothy 1. As I urged you before, when I went to Macedonia, stay there in Ephesus so that you may command certain men not to teach false doctrines any longer, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies. These promote controversies rather than God's work, which is by faith. The goal of this command is love, which comes from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. Now some have wandered away from these and then turned to meaningless talk. They want to be teachers of the law, but they don't know what they're talking about or what they so confidently affirm. We know that the law is good for one uses if it's we know that the law is good if one uses it properly. We also know that the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful and the unholy and irreligious, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers, perverts, and for slave traders and liars and perjurers, and for whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine, that conforms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God which he entrusted into me. Someone has said this: no one gives advice with more authority and enthusiasm than the uninformed. That's true. I've sat in committee meetings where it's the guy who knew the least talked the most. And that's often the way it is with people who want to expound on the gospel. They haven't studied their lesson or done their homework, but yet they know how to lead you astray. It's an age-old problem for self-serving or those who want to enlighten the faithful for some new way of teaching, thus contaminating the purity of the gospel. The Word of God has often been referred to in Scriptures as the living water. And so as we get to those verses and story in a minute, we'll talk about it. But I want to tell you this evening, beware of those who will gladly serve you a clear, cool, and refreshing-looking drink of spiritual water along with a healthy dose of cyanide or false doctrine. You know, from the opening sentence of these verses that I just read in 1 Timothy, Paul says, the glorious gospel of the blessed God. And so Paul is reviewing with Timothy what the gospel really is. And so here we have these verses, a smooth blending of doctrine and behavior. And so many people, evangelicals or conservative Anabaptists or liberal Anabaptists, want to separate doctrine and behavior. It goes together. The gospel is not only a way of thinking, it is a way of living. And it always involves both doctrine and practice. And I want to suggest this. Good doctrine is so important. It determines how we think and view the issues of life. And that is critical. Because if you do not think correctly, you will not live correctly. And what we believe will determine our outward conduct, not only towards God, but towards others. And so don't be fooled into somebody thinking that doctrine don't matter. It matters as much as good living. Part of the problem is probably our insatiable appetites for the new and different. And there will always be a loyal or a following of loyal obedience for teachers who develop clever variations of the gospel. But the bottom line should always be godly edification, not getting a following. Bad doctrine leads us to be okay with sloppy living. And so we have Protestantism and Calvinism, just to name a few. And they will convince you of a false assurance of eternal destiny. I got an invitation on a WhatsApp group chat from a fella to tune in on May the something to listen to a debate between a Reformed Baptist, and I'm not against Baptist people, they're my neighbors and friends, a Reformed Baptist and an Anabaptist brother to discern or have this debate, does God choose who he wants to call? And I just go, well, what's wrong with this guy? Why are we even having this debate? And just to add more confusion to seeking young people. And so I was with Brother Philip today, and we was just saying, you know, we know about 10 or 20 people that just recently fell off the wagon. I mean, like, totally. And they joined the dark side almost, the people that used to burn us at the stake. How did that happen? They got interested in bad doctrine. Okay. How many of y'all remember Jim Jones? More than I thought. But you're all either bald or gray-haired, so Jim Jones, for those of you who don't know. Sam, you remember him? All right. He was a former Methodist minister who started a church predominantly among the African American people in California. He come from the Midwest, Indiana, I think, and he was a Methodist minister. And he moved out to Southern California and started a church, and he was aligned with the Assemblies of God. This is a mainline Pentecostal denomination. But he soon morphed into a church cult leader, faith healer type guy of man worship. And the worship was of Jim Jones, not Muhammad or Hare Krishna or somebody like that. It was Jim Jones worship. And he became an active member of the local Communist Party and idolized Adolf Hitler. Well, the U.S. government got a little bit, I'm not sure about this guy. And they became suspicious of his cult and started to investigate Mr. Jones. And there was a lot of parents in the community who was concerned. They went to law officials and said, you know, our teenage children, our young married children went off with this guy and we never see him and we're not sure what happened to him. And they was concerned. And so they started to check in on him. And so Jim Jones, he smelled a rat. And so he got all his loyal followers and gathered up his assets. And they moved to where? Guyana. Who told me that? Okay, you can't answer this. Where's Guyana? Mr. Good there with the glasses. Where's Guyana? Not that one, the little one.
I don't know.
Pardon?
I don't know.
Okay. Man, we... North coast of South America. Okay. Y'all went to school since I did. Okay. So he moved his cult and his assets into the jungles of Guyana. And life was good, he thought. He was the only one allowed to father children. He had concubines and wives and all that kind of thing. And I believe he fathered children with other men's wives. And so because of the concern of the senator from California, they flew to Guyana and they went and inspected these people, and they was going to let everybody who wanted to leave and come back to California, they were going to make arrangements to fly them home. Well, as the senator and his entourage were going back from the compound to the airport, some of Jim Jones's thugs followed him and gunned them all down there at the airport and riddled the airplane with bullets. And so Jim Jones knew he was really in trouble with the law. And so he had been practicing with his loyal client, his loyal, faithful followers, loyal obedience. And he'd been practicing for them to drink things that he said had poison in, or and he would teach them to train their children to do whatever he asks. When Jim Jones saw what was happening, he had all the adults poison their children. They got big barrels of purple and Kool-Aid, but I don't think it was Kool-Aid brand. And the Kool-Aid people don't like when you use the phrase, they drank the Kool-Aid, because it might have been Jell-O or something else. But it got tagged Kool-Aid. Purple juice laced with cyanide. And so the parents fed their children. They drank it themselves. And then Jim Jones had his girlfriend shoot him. And then she shot herself. And so when the U.S. military came back, let me see how many it actually was. I had 918 souls, 304 of them children. How did he get those people to do that? The same way people will give you cyanide in your spiritual water. You know the fountain free? There's no cyanide in that. And lead you astray and down the trail to spiritual apostasy. Revelation 20, verse 12. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which was the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. And the sea gave up their dead that were in it. And death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. And the lake of fire is the second death. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And then he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of water of life." This is the first good news of all these verses I just read. You can have a drink from the spring of the water of life. And he who overcomes will inherit all of this. And I will be his God and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, and those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, their place will be in the fiery lake of burning sulfur, and that is the second death. This is coincidental that Cousin Samuel, he's one of my 66 first cousins that I was telling you all about last night, and he's also a rock star. But anyway, I was at your place today, Samuel, and I was looking. I used to live there when I was a boy. And over in the woods beside this one field where we had to pick rocks every spring and every fall, and we pick rocks, and it's a futile activity because there's more there the next year. But anyway, Dad thought that was very important. But when it got hot and we got tired, we knew of a place over in the woods outside the fence where there was a big tree. And under that tree, it was all moss laying there, and there was water bubbling up out of the ground under that tree. And we'd lay down on our stomach on that moss, and we'd drink. And that water was so cold and so clear and so good, and there was no cyanide in it. And that's just one of the memories. So, Samuel, today I looked over there. Your woods look trashed out. There's not a hint of cyanide or false or erroneous teaching in that spring in what is now Samuel's farm. But also notice something else. Samuel had not one big concrete basin there, cauldron to put his waste from his big dairy in. He has two of them. You know, when I'm thirsty, you're thirsty and we're up at Samuel's. I'm sure if you ask him, he'll let you get a drink out of those pits. Me, I know where that spring is over under that tree. I'm going there, but my concern is your pits are getting pretty close to the spring. I called you a couple months ago and asked you about it because I was writing this. I wanted to verify that you hadn't put cyanide in it yet.
It's still flowing. Clear.
You drink it? It's safe to drink?
Safe to drink.
Good. But why do so many people go up there by his dairy and drink out of that thing? They do? Would you let someone drink there? There's a lot of people that do. Beware of books, podcasts, video clips, or publications written by those whose faith and practice and application is weak at best or is obviously not applying the whole truth of Scripture. Remember, we are never more spiritual than we are scriptural. Okay? You're going to learn that one night. I'm about running out of nights. But you can learn it now, okay? You are never more spiritual than you are scriptural. It is a grave and serious responsibility for those who are given the responsibility of teaching to be negligent about maintaining the purity of the gospel. And that's not just for church leaders, it's for you mom and dads too. Train your children to grow up to be faithful in their generation, pillars in the church. 1 Corinthians 9:16, for though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for the necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is me if I preach not the gospel. Woe are you if you do not train and teach your children. That's my version. I want to morph into something else. Cyanide in the Anabaptist movie culture. I don't know what your old standard here is. I'm pretty sure it's like ours. But I get into a lot of places and a lot of young people and teach. I taught for 12 years at Heritage Bible School, and I look back on that with fond memories. And I still teach at Institute of Global Opportunities in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And so I have access to a lot of young people. And movies is a big thing. When I was a boy, there was three young men had to get up in our church and confess that they were standing on the sidewalk at Jess's Lunch. Is that still there? Where there was a movie theater, and they went in and they watched Ben-Hur. And I don't know what Ben-Hur is, but I think it's kind of a Dick, Jane, and Sally movie compared to what most people watch. Is it? It's kind of like harmless. They got churched for it. And I'm just giving you that. I'm not saying those boys were right. I'm just saying somebody went down the street and told on them. A young man can choose to look at pornography and have thoughts and emotions awakened in him that were not meant to be aroused outside of marriage. And sad to say, some do. A young lady can just as easily turn to romance novels, movies, and music, which can be found instantly on YouTube or online. To a woman, this is pornography, both visual and emotional. It fills her hearts with thoughts and desires and longings that cannot be fulfilled in a godly way. It sets expectations in her heart for a relationship that can never be that perfect. And she can easily feed her emotions or desires by watching a couple enjoy each other being intimate, feeling cherished, or even though this couple is 100% play acting. This only sows discontent and awakens desires within the girl where God opens that before God opens that door. And so I ask, is it okay for your mama to go to work making Christian movies and schlecking? You know what that word means? There's no Dutch people. I'm not Dutch, but my wife did. Do you know Dutch? It means to lick. Okay. They're schlecking, or that's Dutch for licking. Hugging and kissing up on some dude that's not her husband. And then they come home and cook supper and help the children with their homework and go off to bed with their dad. Somehow I have a problem with that. Romans 1:32, although they knew God's righteous decree and those that do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. That verse tells me that when we enjoy watching other people sin, that we partake in their sins. I don't care if you're into NASCAR on Sunday afternoon. That is the most ungodly, promoted by the alcohol industry and naked ladies. And yet so many evangelicals are really into NASCAR. When you enjoy watching other people sin, you partake in their sin. Romans 1:32. And so I don't care if it's pro sports or whatever it is, all that nonsense. And so these communities where they set the big screen up on Super Bowl Sunday and then they have Sunday school and then they go watch the ball game, what do they do with all that nonsense? Those halftime shows, the debauchery, the nudity, the ungodliness is worse than the golden calf in your church. Well, then how about bringing it into your home? God has given each of us a healthy imagination. We must take every thought captive to Jesus. 2 Corinthians 10:4. The world today has sexualized everything, and it's only going to get worse. And as God's people today, we must guard our eyes, our ears, and our hearts in almost every way we can. And it's the saddest when we have to guard them at our own church functions. In 2024, it is almost impossible to find media that does not involve profanity, immorality, sensuality, sexuality, or violence. And to top it off, most of the sexuality that's in the movies isn't between a husband and a wife, which I mentioned above. Movies are so destructive to a mind that desires to be content and selfless and righteous and pure. So why would we want to bring the immorality, the immodesty, and the spiritual fight against the world into our homes, bedrooms, friendships through movies and media? And I've heard families say, well, we just look at this after the children go to bed. Well, if it's wrong for the children to see it, it's wrong for you, and whatever happened to setting an example. I'm not going to get up here and tell you this evening that 100% of the movie culture is evil, but much of it is. Anything your heart desires can be found on YouTube, the internet, or by downloading and watching a movie. Anything. Why play with fire? I believe that every day the devil tempts the hearts and leads our hearts and leads them astray through YouTube and other media outlets like Netflix and other online movie streaming services. You cannot innocently search for something wholesome and instantly be tempted. You can be searching for something wholesome and instantly be tempted with 20 other picture options of quick and sinful things to watch. Media is not the only source of struggle for young ladies. It tends to be overlooked and misunderstood that many or not most women can be visual people too. The way a man dresses shows much about his heart, just as the attire of a woman can show the intentions of her heart. If you have not thought about this before, please think about it now. As a young man, are you trying to keep your body a secret as much you expect that of a young lady's? Men cannot dismiss the fact that women can identify with their struggle because they have been told over and over that their primary gate to sexual stimulation is visual. Well, I want to tell you, it works for women too. So why do girls go to the beach in groups and they look at those men and they talk about their hunks and their this and their that? Women cannot overlook a man's struggle, and we must be sympathetic to the women's struggle as well. We need to feed the spiritual man, and I want to make some suggestions. Women have lust, desire, struggles too. Most women are visual too. Don't fool yourself. It has been preached and promoted far too long that this is a guy-only thing. That's simply not true. Every year, the evangelists would come to Heritage Bible School, good guys, and the guys would be sitting over here, and they just kind of park here and look at them, and they would reduce them to a pulp like they were some kind of bottom feeding. And the women got a free pass. And they was reading their steamy novels and watching chick flicks and stuff. Well, boy, them guys was giving it to the guys in front of the girls. I got tired of it. And they made the mistake of asking me to be the evangelist there the other year. And I turned to the girls. And I talked about movie culture. And it's about 30 of them got up at the end and went into the prayer room. Good girls. But you see, the focus has been on the guys. I want to tell you this evening that for every godly man, every godly girl, I think there's just as many godly young men. They're not all perverts. A young lady will have deeper respect for a guy if she witnesses him guarding his eyes. I had a couple from the West Coast work for me, and she lived in another culture, and the West is pretty rough. And there was a man came from Select Sires and wanted to buy the heifers they had. And so we had to crawl through some barbed wire fence. And this lady went to crawl through the fence, and the man from Select Sires, he turned and looked over there at the trees or the moon or the stars. And then they went and looked at their heifers, and he came back. He turned and looked and let her go through the fence. And she says, "I have never seen somebody." This guy didn't really claim to be a Christian. "I have never seen that kind of respect in the West Coast. Every guy is trying to see what he can get by with." And so women are impressed, young men, old men, when you protect their modesty. There is something so attractive about a guy that guards his eyes. It makes a girl feel safe, secure. It makes her feel valued beyond her body. And when a man talks to a poorly dressed woman that has the strength to only look her in the eye, a girl's respect deepens. There is nothing lastingly attractive about a man that is undisciplined and lustful. And now to the ladies. If you expect guys to guard their eyes, you must guard yours. And most ladies have huge and healthy imaginations too. You are not alone. God has made you female. He has made you beautiful and attractive to those of the opposite gender. No, your brain isn't messed up. If you desire romance and companionship, God made you that way. There are some women who cannot grasp or understand the power that they have over a young man. A godly lady instills within a man the desire to be better than he can be and helps him fight and walk for the moral high road. It will be a lifelong and constant battle to cultivate dedicated hearts that refuse to relax in the area of personal purity. We must dismiss the evil thoughts. And when our minds, we go places that we wouldn't in real life, that too is sin. We must recognize these things. Most of the media that comes through the eye gate is the devil's workshop. Lust is sin. It may be very common, but that doesn't make it okay. And just because our peers or our church leaders don't know, that doesn't make it okay either. God sees, He knows, and He cares. He is a just God, and He will judge our thoughts and actions and motives. God desires to see us walk in victory, and He will help us. And then lastly, sexual intimacy is a beautiful thing designed by God, but only in the confines of marriage. And ever since the Garden of Eden, the devil has been hard at work, finding ways to pervert it and make it shameful and dirty. I myself am not a big fan of movies in general. It's not my temptation. I can and have enjoyed educational documentaries, but again, with discretion. I do not have time to watch movies, and I hope that you would not watch movies even if you did have a lot of time. So why do people watch movies? Why do conservative Christian Anabaptist people seem to be so addicted to movies? A movie is not just a movie. It's a method of shaping society and your worldview. And it provides through a process of behaviors that blurs the distinctions between real life and imaginary make-believe experiences. It creates a false sense of reality. It replaces God's discretion in making processing decisions. A culture of movie watching has developed among young Anabaptist people. And movies are shaping and impacting young lives and ways of the world. I'm warning you. Watching movies has become a way to take a break from life and allow the screen, both large and small, to present its version of life. It allows the watcher to disengage from life's daily difficulties and allows us to experience a wide range of experiences and emotions. It meets people at all levels of arousal, and it engages them in sinful emotional images that are burned into their minds, and those images create a separate reality in their mind. And now, I want to give you a couple reasons why I think you shouldn't watch movies. It creates a lack of spiritual discernment, a lack of discretion, desensitization to immodesty, to immorality, to violence, to vile behaviors, to vile language, and to the violation of biblical teaching. It's when sin becomes normal. I worked on a harvest crew in 1976. And there was guys that had a TV there in the camper where we stayed. And, you know, it was there. And I can't believe after 6 months how you get used to normal. Violence, filthiness, dirty talk, making fun of godly things. And you can just wear down. You don't even have to really be zeroed in watching it. The liberal, worldly agenda that is attacking the foundations of our society for many years is often expressed coming from Hollywood, love stories, mysteries, thrillers of all sort. They catch and captivate our minds and our eyes. Many millions and billions of dollars are invested in the production, and it's a misinformation line to feed young lives. Behaviors and appearances of men and women are paraded before our eyes. And then the next thing we know, we have this cool talk cliches and pick up movie lines. We hear our people saying things that they learn from the movies. Movies create an unchristian worldview. It's not just a movie. Hollywood knows the power of images. And movies not only represent, but they also shape society. They will shape you and your children's life as well. And you do not want your life and heart to be shaped by Hollywood, but by God and His Word. It is your choice. You can't have it both ways. Psalm 101:3, I will set no evil thing before my eyes. When I was in Nicaragua, one time to visit one of my sons. We went in February. Don't go in February. The dry coast is so hot. It rains for 6 months and then it don't rain for 6 months. And the hot wind blows and there's dust and dirt everywhere. And I was sitting in church that Sunday morning. And I don't understand Spanish. And I apologize to Jason Schantz now. I'm sure he had a good sermon, but my mind drifted. I was hot and I was thirsty. And in my mind, I saw a tall green glass bottle of Coca-Cola sitting on the table. And there was beads of sweat on that bottle. and they were running down and down and making a little puddle on the table. And then the fizzes were coming out the top. And I longed as I sat there in church for that Coca-Cola. I was so thirsty. But I want to assure you this evening, there's no cold Coca-Colas in hell. There's no water there either. The only water there has got cyanide in it. 2 Corinthians 6:2, for he saith, and I heard thee in a time accepted into the day of the salvation. Have I succored or favored thee? Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation. No one is forced to yield or live a life for God while we live what is called time and today. But the scriptures are full of invitations of Christ calling us to Christ and giving us life-giving water, pure life-giving water. Now, John 7:37, and Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture says, streams of living water will flow from without him. No cyanide. Clear, cold, living water. Revelation 22, it's a familiar verse. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him who hears say, come. Whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever drinks, wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life from that fountain free that you sang about this evening. Life-giving water with no cyanide. None of us here remember Calvin Coolidge. He was a senator before he was a president, and he was presided over the Senate as vice president. And one day, back in 1920s, two senators got in an argument. Imagine that. I thought that was only a recent thing, where politicians were polite and ugly to each other. And this one senator called ugly and angrily to the other senator and told him to go straight to hell. The offended senator complained to him as the presiding officer, and he told Mr. Coolidge, that, what are you going to do about this guy calling me these ugly names? And Mr. Coolidge looked up from the book that he'd been leafing through, and it was the bylaws of the rules of Congress of the Senate floor. And he says this, I've been looking through the rule book. It says that you don't have to go. And so I'm here to tell you this evening that you don't have to go to hell either. But if you insist on drinking from springs other than the living water that Jesus gives, you have made your own choice. Remember, we are free to make our choices, but we are not free from the consequences of those choices. Well, I need to close, but I want to tell you. Some years ago, Grace and I went to see her ailing mother. She had cancer. And so we went, started out, and we were going to stop and visit her brother in London, Ontario, on the way to Red Lake. And so that took us close to Detroit. And we had a little time one morning in Detroit, and I'd always heard that the Henry Ford Museum was, you need to go to the Henry Ford Museum. And I didn't know what time it opened. We showed up at 8 o'clock, and there was people milling around there in the entrance. But the gates to buy tickets were closed, and there was no one official there. And then I noticed that it opened at 9. So what was I going to do with an hour? Well, there was this little old man came up to us and said, did you all come here to see the museum? And I said, yes, sir, we did. He said, well, let me tell you, I know Henry Ford. I used to work for Henry Ford, and I have a lifetime pass to this museum. And if you come back here at 9 o'clock, you meet me right here. Don't go over there and buy a ticket. You just meet me right here. I will take you in. Well, I didn't know if he was for real or not, but I decided I was going to risk it. And so Grace and I went out and looked at Thomas Edison's house. Henry Ford had drug a lot of these old houses and made this village this down from there. And that little man said, you know, I come here every morning to walk and get my exercise in these big halls before the crowds come. And so you just meet me back here. And so we did. And we came in and there was hundreds of people lined up over here to get tickets. And I thought, well, should I get in line? You know, how can I trust this man? And so we stood over here. Sure enough, here he come, a smile as big as Texas. He said, follow me. And we went down this hall, long hall, and turned up another long hall. And there was a big bars, big gates that you couldn't get through. And right beside those big gates along the wall was a big oak roll-top desk. I don't know if it was Henry Ford's or not. And he said, follow me. And there was a woman sitting at that desk and looked like sugar wouldn't melt in her mouth. As we come walking up there, I didn't know Henry Ford. I had never worked for Henry Ford. I had no reason to be there. I didn't have a ticket. I didn't have anything but the little old man. And he walked up to that desk and he tapped that woman's desk and he says, there with me. Let them in. And she stuck out her hands and she put that purple stamp on and we went in and the little old man disappeared. I want to tell you, all of us need to know Jesus. And when he takes us to eternity, he can get us through that gate. And he can say, let him in. He's with me. But if you don't know Jesus, you can't get in. And if you got cruddy stuff in your heart and you enjoy feeding on Sinai water, Jesus ain't going to open the gate for you. But tonight, you can be free from anything that you know hinders you from being let in by Jesus. Let them in. They're with me. I paid the price. Mr. Good, I want to sing one verse of Just As I Am. I'm not going to plead with you. The Holy Spirit can make you feel way more miserable than I can. But if you have something that you want to get relieved from, stand to your feet. I acknowledge you, and one of your ministry can meet with you. Shall we sing? Stand if you feel you need to. Ask you for stand for closing prayer. Samuel, would you lead that prayer and then lead your song then?